Welcome to Creative Maine, an hour-long monthly program produced for and broadcast by WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, and at weru.org. This show considers the making of craft, fine art, food, literature, music, dance, museums, and any other form of creative expression here in Maine. We also discuss topics of global cultural significance and interest. My name is Adina Salmonson, and I am your host for this monthly exploration of all things creative. Should you have comments, questions, input, or suggestions for the show, send them to info@weru.org. Please list Creative Maine in the subject line. The life of the arts is a test of the quality of a nation's civilization, said JFK. As a lifelong musician and crafter, I am thrilled to be presenting my areas of interest and passion to you on our wonderful community radio station right here in my Orland backyard. On today's show, we will chat with several interesting guests. Casey Ryder, the proprietor of Port Fiber in Portland, who has connected Maine to Tajikistan by a thread. Lisa Ladd, the director of the Buck Memorial Library in Bucksport, and Nolan Welch, who welcomes folks to the library and teaches them to crochet. And Jeremy Brothers and Ryan Gall, an improv comedy team that also creates horror films. Welcome, Casey Ryder, to Creative Maine. I'm so glad that you could come on our program. I met you while we were vending. You were vending at Fiber Frolic. So you are the owner of Port Fiber in Portland. So tell us a little bit about your business. What is it? How did you get into it and so forth?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I own Port Fiber, which is a fiber arts supply shop. We're in East Bayside in Portland, kind of near all of the breweries. And yeah, we sell yarn for knitters and crocheters, weavers. We've got fiber for spinners. We support needle felters and wet felters and all sorts of fibery folks.
Okay, all the good stuff.
Yeah, we've been down here for, I'll be celebrating 11 years of ownership in October.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That's a milestone.
Yes, and we've been down here for 12 years, and I bought the shop from the previous owner, Melody Hackett, in 2013, and she, I think, had owned the shop for maybe 13 years before that. So it used to be up on Congress Street, and it was called the Portland Fiber Gallery and Weaving Studio.
Wow, so it's kind of a Portland institution.
Yes.
Definitely a destination for fiberistas, I would say.
Definitely. I've definitely seen a lot of people visiting Maine this summer. I feel like the out-of-state visitors, it's really obvious in the summertime.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. So, but I'm sure you have your local dedicatees.
The regulars, they start to show up now. You know, once gardens start to wind down, when gardens get put to bed, I feel like the locals show up again.
That's really funny. So tell us about you and your creative journey before Port Fiber.
Yeah, I grew up in the Bangor area. Grandmother taught me to sew when I was very little, 4 or 5, like just a needle and thread and sewing 2 squares together. And she showed me how to use the sewing machine pretty young also. So I was really into making quilts for all my little cousins and making quilts for myself. And I got into sewing clothing more in high school. Joann Fabrics was one of my first real jobs.
Oh, wow.
And so that was a slippery slope for your paycheck, just going straight back into buying fabric. And then my grandmother also taught me to knit in middle school, but I didn't really get into it until college. And I joined there was like a Stitch and Bitch group of knitters.
Where did you go to school?
I went to UMaine Farmington to be a teacher. And I was certified K-8 and never found a full-time teaching position. I did a lot of substitute teaching after college, and I moved to Portland kind of to be involved in the Ultimate Frisbee community because I was a part of that in college. And there was just this natural migration of UMaine Farmington Ultimate players coming to Portland. So that's how I ended up down here. And then I was looking for a knitting community right out of college. And I wandered into what was the Portland Fiber Gallery and Weaving Studio looking for yarn. And they didn't have a ton of yarn at the time, but they did say you should just take a spinning class and you could learn how to make your own yarn. So I
Now,
did
I just
that.
want to clarify for many of our listeners, spinning is understood to be a sport like bicycling.
Yes.
So I just want to make sure we all know what we are referring to when we say
Yes.
spinning.
No, not on a stationary bicycle.
What is
No.
it? What is it
It's
for?
using, well, I was learning how to use a spinning wheel to make my own yarn. So just taking the wool fiber and using the spinning wheel to add twists to it and create your own yarns.
Yeah, I there's a bit of a disconnect there sometimes.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
So, okay, so you're an ultimate frisbee knitter. And how did you come to be the proprietor of this store that you wandered into?
Well, I took that spinning class and then I also took a dyeing class and then I started interning there. And then I learned all these other things like weaving and felting. And just like, yeah, getting to know the fiber arts community in Portland, which is pretty big. It's a pretty solid community.
Pretty active too, yeah.
Yeah. And I worked for Mel part-time interning and then also was nannying for a set of triplets. I was waitressing. I worked part-time at a fabric shop on Warren Avenue. Yeah, I
Anything but
was doing that
substitute
like
teaching.
And substitute teaching, yes, I feel like I was patching it all together as you do in your early 20s, and then was able to slowly let go of some of those jobs and work more at Port Fiber. I worked for her, I think, for about 3 years before she really was ready to retire, and I was her only employee, and she asked if I wanted to buy the business, and she like allowed me to, she kind of like helped me with finding classes. Like I took a class on how to write a business proposal, like all this stuff. And she really let me take over running the shop for probably a year, just so I could see if it was something that I thought I could do. Took out a business loan and
Oh,
did
wow. Started adulting big
it.
time.
Yeah, I think I was 28 when I bought the shop and I'm 39 now. I think that I did it and I didn't really know what I was doing, and you just learn as you
But you've been doing
go.
it. 11 years is quite a milestone to run any business. So that's huge.
Thanks.
So one of the things that makes Port Fiber so unusual and unique is that it supports an international philanthropic endeavor, which is fascinating. Now, I was really struck by the fact that you have a connection with people on the other side of the world. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So I work with a women's cooperative called Cashmere People Yarns, and they are in Tajikistan in Central Asia.
I bet most of us could not find that on a map.
I definitely did not know where it was before I met these women, but it borders China and Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan. I met them, I think it was in 2016 in the wintertime. They were here in the States, kind of touring the Northeast for like fiber events, fiber and yarn related events. Okay, let me back up a little bit. Or the whole project was funded by a Italian grant that was focused on sustainable agriculture and supporting women in business. And it was, I kind of came in towards the end of like 8 years of training, and I was kind of the last little, I don't know, the
Link in the
last step.
chain.
The last step, yeah. But in 2016, they were selling some of their yarn, a small yarn dyeing business in the, I think in Connecticut. And some of that yarn was at Vogue Knitting Live, which is a huge event in New York City. And so they were going to that, and then they were kind of touring fiber processing mills, farms, shops. And my connection to them was through Peter Haggerty, who owned Peace Fleece and lives in Maine. And he asked if they could come to one of my spinning groups and just like do a little talk about their project and sell their yarn to the spinners who come here. So I advertised that. We had a really good turnout. They had their translator with them, so we could really kind of ask. We could really communicate, about the project. Everybody had their spinning wheels, so that was nice to like connect in that way and learn about the project. That was kind of that. And then maybe a few months later, Peter called me and asked if I would consider being their wholesale distributor. And that part of that would mean that I would go to Tajikistan and meet all of the women for 2 weeks. And so I said, yes, please. That sounds great. Yes. And I visited them in March of 2017. And that was I think I came home the day after their grant ended. Like this was really the last puzzle piece. And I'm so glad for that experience to meet all of these incredible people making this really beautiful quality yarn.
So when you sell Cashmere People yarns, you're not just a business link. You are really a lifeline.
I got to meet them. Like, I got to meet the makers. Yeah, and see, I don't know, I got to be in their homes. I got to dance with them. I got to eat with them. That's so special. Yeah, that's so special.
That's one, and you're part of their success in life, right? You're helping to feed their children and
No pressure.
send them to school, no pressure. That's amazing. And that one shop in Maine can do all that is tremendous. Now, Peace Fleece, he was originally working with Russians, correct?
Yes, he was working with in the 80s. He was combining wool from Russia with wool from the US. Yeah, making this really
And
great,
now he
diverse,
works
great
with the
yarn.
Navajo Nation, yes.
Now he's sourcing the wool from the Navajo Nation and then the mohairs from Texas. And that gets, it's the yarn is made by Harrisville Yarns in New Hampshire.
But in
Yes.
this case, these women are making the yarn themselves. You're not involved with a mill. They are,
Right.
in essence, their own mill.
Yes. And the agricultural grant was focused on sustainable agriculture. A lot of the cashmere that we get is sourced from China, and the grazing practices are not great. So
Questionable.
the land is kind of getting decimated, and so this grant was focused on sustaining smaller flocks in the I believe it's the Western Himalayas. So most of the goats are like small family farms, like not a lot, maybe like 10 or 12 goats. And then the community brings all their goats together to go graze together in the mountains. And then they come back in the winter and do their little cozy vibe in their smaller
And
goat communities. And so
the skein of yarn reaches all the way to Maine.
And then the skein comes to Maine, and then the skein goes to wherever the person takes it, I guess.
That's
Yeah.
phenomenal. That's very exciting. So, how can WERU listeners learn more about Cashmere People and like initiatives? How can they participate and get involved in supporting this and other fiber philanthropies?
Well, you can check out their website, cashmerepeopleyarns.com, and that will tell you the story in more detail. And there's also part of that their website is you can see the bio like a small biography of the spinners. You can read about a little bit about their lives and how this money is changing their lives. And if you're interested, if you work with yarn and you'd like to try it out, you can check it out at portfiber.com, and or maybe one of your local shops near you is carrying Cashmere People yarns already. So you could check out the stockist page, maybe support your other local business. Although I'm guessing WERU listeners are maybe based in Maine. So you could also just come to my shop.
WERU listeners are based in Maine, but we have WERU.org, so people anywhere in the world can listen
Amazing.
and
Amazing.
do, apparently. They are all over the place.
Yes. Well, if anybody's in Portland, Oregon, I'll be there in November and you can touch Cashmere People yarns in real life.
Is that
But
it?
also just come to Port Fiber. Just come on
Port,
down.
come to Port Fiber. So, how can somebody reach you, Casey Ryder, and Port Fiber?
Well, my email is portfiber@gmail.com. And you could come to our physical location Wednesday through Saturday, 11 to 5. It's 50 Cove Street in East Bayside in Portland.
Fantastic. And I'm sure you have a phone number too that can
Yes, our
be.
phone number is 207-780-1345. And we're also on Instagram and Facebook, just under Port Fiber.
Perfect. Well, thank you so very much. This has been a wonderful conversation. I'm so excited about the yarn. I can say for myself, I got to squeeze it at the Maine Fiber Frolic, and it's absolutely stunning. Very
Yes.
beautiful, as I'm sure are all the yarns at Port Fiber. So thank you so much for coming on, and I'll look forward to seeing you at upcoming fiber events.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome, Nolan Welch and Lisa Ladd, to Creative Maine. I'm so glad to have you on the program. Lisa is the executive director of the Buck Memorial Library in Bucksport, Maine. And Nolan is what you would call a volunteer extraordinaire and has a very special program that he's going to be telling us about. So, Nolan, describe your creative journey. I have given nothing away here, so you can go from the beginning. What do you do? What do you do for the library, and how did you get there?
So my creative journey probably started when I was around 7 years old.
And you are how
I
old now, Nolan?
13.
Very good.
So the reason it probably started was I used to do a lot of crafts and I loved to draw and things like that when I was younger. And for when I was in public school, I had to, as a study for Indians, I had to, and Native Americans, I would, we had to weave in art class, and I figured it out, and I really liked weaving. So for a while, I was weaving, and I made little tapestries and things like that. And eventually, I didn't really weave a lot anymore. So I would, instead, I tried to take up crocheting from YouTube videos. Because I didn't have an influence of crocheting at the time. And I didn't really get the hang of it from those. But from then on, I tried knitting from YouTube videos and I did figure it out and it was actually fun for me. So I took a 8-week knitting class in Belfast, Maine at Heavenly Yarns.
Oh, yeah.
And it worked out really well for me. And I ended up liking it even more, and I knit for a long time. And about a year later, I tried to take up crocheting again. And when I did, I figured it out and I really liked it. And it was a lot quicker for me. So I kept crocheting, and the reason I got started on the amigurumi, which is kind of the next step, because you learn like crocheting in lines before. Was because I found a book here at the library on amigurumi and I wanted to try it out and I did and I really liked it. And since then I've been doing mostly that.
Can you define amigurumi for us?
So most crochet works in continuous lines. over and over just to build it up. Amigurumi is a form of crocheting that works in a spiral to create circles, and it's used for stuffed animals and creatures like that. That's the basis of amigurumi.
Okay, fine. So how, what are you doing at the library? You're doing something very special.
At the library now, on Thursdays every other week, I am teaching a crochet class open to the public. So anybody can come to the library and learn to crochet, and it's entirely free. And we have supplies, and you can come and try to learn how to crochet. And I teach it, so that's great. Yeah.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, I'm going to talk to Lisa Ladd for a moment. You're the executive director of the library. I know you have a creative journey, and I would maintain that your most wonderful creation is what you have made of the Buck Memorial Library. But how does Nolan's crochet class fit into your vision for the library?
My concentration in library science was youth librarianship, but I also am part of the local Age and Ability Friendly Committee here in Bucksport. And one of the key things that I feel very strongly about is bringing multiple ages together in for our programming, whether that be weekly story times, which we do every week, where we have young children and their older siblings, and then caregivers, which could be the parent, but it could be the grandparent or a favorite aunt or a friend. And so our story times each week always are two stories, and then we do a craft that is based around the stories that we read. So when Nolan approached me and said that he was thinking that he'd like to try to teach a crochet class, my initial reaction was, absolutely, but are you okay with it being for any age? And we talked about that, and Nolan was amenable to that. And so from the very beginning, this class has been comprised of children who are, in grade school and middle grade and high schoolers and all the way up to senior citizens. And it's, to me, just a wonderful way to build community. A lot of our young people may not have grandparents that are in the area. I'm seeing a lot of mentoring going on in these programs, and that's really my goal. We do a lot of different programming here at the library, and we try as much as possible to make it intergenerational when appropriate. You know, we do ghost port, we do any time that there's a big program in town, then we're usually there. We've participated in Bay Fest and Orland River Day in the past. This year it didn't work out due to staffing, but we try as much as possible to just get the word out that libraries are for everybody and our programs are for everybody.
Very good. So that encompasses the vision. I think that's wonderful. So the library, though physically small, is indeed a community center. And do you envision any other creative classes at the libraries or other crafts or
We've done certain programs with the Grace Arts program in the past, specifically around summer reading. We've also this summer we were at the farmers market three times, and that included again stories and crafts for all ages. Another thing that we've done in the past that I really enjoy is we've purchased tiny canvases and easels. And just put them out for people on specific days and said, you know, this year it was like, what's your favorite thing to do this summer? What's a favorite place you like to visit in the summer? And then we just put the tiny art up everywhere in the library. And so other things that we're thinking about doing, we're hoping to host our first art show with Home Inc. They're going to be coming in this afternoon to see if the space would work for them. This would be in November. We're also on the Thursdays that Nolan is not with us, and today is our first day of trying this, we've had families express how they wish that we had story time later in the afternoon, going into the evenings. And Thursdays are our late day. We're here until 6. So today, from 3 to 5, we're going to do drop-in fall crafts and have people on hand to read stories to anybody who wants to come. It doesn't matter whether you're 5 or 100, listening to somebody else read a book is always kind of nice and pleasant. And we're hoping again that we can provide that same story time that our kids get in the summer before they go back to school.
So for an adult, it would be sort of a live Libby situation.
Yes, but with picture books. But hopefully favorite picture books. But yes, we're just hoping, we're trying some different things. Thursdays used to be our STEAM nights, and for a while it was very successful. And then what we have found lately is that with so many kids being in sports and robotics, that it kind of dropped off, and it was an awful lot of work for us to set those things up. So we're going to try something a little bit more low bar and see how that goes. And we're always open to suggestions, and we like bringing in different people with ideas. So certainly, if you are an artist or a creative person who wants to approach me with a program idea, people can always get in touch with me, and we can see if it would work.
That's wonderful. We're going to announce your contact info a little bit later.
Yes.
Nolan, back to you. So, can you describe your experience as a teacher? They do say teaching is the best way for the teacher to learn. And what have you learned by teaching crochet, especially to people of different ages? And can you compare your teaching experience with your learning experience on YouTube videos?
Yes. So I do think my teaching experience has taught me things too. It is sometimes a little challenging to teach people of all different ages at different stages in their crocheting. But I have had people here who've never crocheted before and people who've been crocheting their whole lives and just want to learn a certain thing. So it's always easy to have a group of people who are a little bit of both, so I can focus on people who really need it and help them more. So if they're a total beginner, I'll teach them all the basics and then get them to what they'd like to learn. And if they are not new to crocheting and have experience, I will teach them the exact thing they'd like to learn.
Wow.
And I've done two private tutorings before. One was with a girl who had been crocheting for a little while and wanted to learn how to progress. And another was with one of my neighbors who'd been crocheting for about 20 years and just didn't know how to do the amigurumi and wanted to learn it. And both of those turned out really well. So teaching is fun for me, and I do enjoy having the class here.
So tell me a little more about how your program is structured. Obviously, everybody's doing their own thing, right? They come in with
Yeah.
their own. So would you ever do a class where everybody makes the same project, or do you find that a little confining?
I feel like I would consider doing something like that, but I think it's easier for all the people involved to have a structure where they can learn the specific thing they want to learn. So I bring a bag or a bin of examples that I've made to give people ideas and inspire them to make certain things that they'd like to make. And the library here has lots of books on crochet, so I will normally set those out on the table as well so people can look at those and if they want to learn something. So I wouldn't know if I want to do some sort of like everybody does the same thing because I like teaching people how they want to learn.
How is your project funded? This is open to either of you. How do you get the materials, the tools? Do folks bring their own? How does that work?
So the initial startup, when Nolan approached me, Nolan very generously donated quite a bit of yarn to the beginning of the project, and I invested in getting some crochet hooks of different sizes just to have on hand. And we made the conscious decision that People could go home with those crochet hooks. We're not checking them out. They're just gratis, part of the program. In addition to that, a lot of us have either been knitters or crocheters in a former life or are still. And so we have had, quite a few donations of good quality yarn, both cotton and then wool. And I think it's been, fortunately for me, one of my more inexpensive programs. So much of the time I'm scrambling when I've got 25 or 30 kids for story time to see whether I have enough supplies for whatever our craft is that day. And certainly with summer reading program, that can be a very expensive summer crafts and bringing in special speakers and then, excuse me, also purchasing the prizes that we give away. So, crochet has been really low bar for us in many, many ways. There's not a lot of setup. There's not, just not a lot of expense.
Sit down and do it. Yep.
Yes, exactly.
That's great. So, Nolan, tell us what is next for you? What are some of your vocational aspirations? And has this experience of teaching a crochet class changed your mind about what you might want to do or study in the future?
So I think it did a little bit. It has changed what I aspire to do. I originally wanted to own some sort of tea shop where I would sell tea I made. And since I've learned crocheting, I've always thought it would be, I've taken up other things too. I've taken up baking and I love to read. So I always thought it would be really cool to own like a cafe bookstore of some sort.
I agree. That would be nirvana, wouldn't it? A
Yeah.
cafe bookstore. And why don't you throw in a craft section on top of it? Yeah. So,
I would, yeah.
oh gosh, yeah. Lisa, what advice would you give to our listeners who may want to start a similar program in their own library?
I think as somebody who's only been at the reins here for about 3.5 years, be open to your community, be open to suggestions that they may approach you with, whether that be, a painting course or crochet, or whether you have local authors who would like to do a book festival. Library directors are busy, especially small rural library directors like myself. I'm basically a solo-ish librarian. I'm the only full-time worker, and then we only have one other person for 12 hours a week, and the rest is volunteer. And so I do all the things, and sometimes I have to just kind of take a deep breath and say, okay, yes, I think this could work. How much of it is going to, impact my time and my budget? And as I said, with this particular program, I knew that it was going to be relatively self-sufficient. Nolan has not shared this, but he and his family have also volunteered at another library in Maine, so he has library experience. So, the very fact that he knew to go to the shelf and pull down the crochet books to display, that isn't necessarily something that all of my program people would know to do. So, I think be aware that there are all kinds of people in your community that may have really cool talents to share with you. And if you have a programming budget, even if it's a tiny one, there are grants out there as well, for certain things. And this has been such a win in my mind, because when crochet ceases every year, in the springtime, and then we take it up again in the fall, I will have patrons come in and say, when is crochet starting again? So it's definitely something that people look forward to, and it's just very energizing for me to walk into the room and see this range of ages and abilities all working towards a common goal of learning a new craft.
That's amazing. So, how can our Creative Maine listeners find your program and get more information, and how can they get involved?
So, the best place to find out what we are up to is our website, bucklibrary.org. And then we also have a very active Facebook account. Again, just look for Buck Memorial Library on Facebook. We are open 5 days a week, Tuesday through Saturday, various hours. But we always encourage people to come to our library. It's a beautiful building. It's on the National Register. We may be small, but we consider ourselves pretty mighty. And we really just enjoy meeting others from all over Maine. And we've been very happy this year to be hosting a lot of people from cruise ships in Bucksport Harbor. So we've definitely had a new clientele than we normally see.
Thank you both so very much for coming on Creative Maine. You can listen on 89.9 FM or WERU.org. And thank you so much. We look forward to speaking with you again soon. Good luck, Nolan.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Adina.
Creative Maine is alive with activities, presentations, workshops, concerts, and all manner of cultural endeavors. At this point in the show, we highlight a few of the many calendar items going on around the region. Ghostport is Bucksport, Maine's annual spooky festival. On October 19th, as part of the Ghostport festivities, the Buck Memorial Library on Main Street in Bucksport will be presenting Potions on the Porch from 10 to 1. On Halloween itself, the library will be open until 6 p.m., hosting drop-in crafts from 4 to 6. Treats will be handed out, so no tricks are required. For more information, go to bucklibrary.org. Also at Ghostport, Nolan Welch will be selling his crochet stuffies at a booth appropriately entitled Stuff It. 10 Bucks Theater will be presenting Scary Stories, stage renderings of spooky tales by Edgar Allan Poe, H.P. Lovecraft, and others from October 17th through October 27th at the Bangor Mall. For more information, go to 10BucksTheater.org or visit 10 Bucks Theater on Facebook or Instagram. Saturday, November 23rd at 7:30 and 9:30 p.m., the Waldo Theater in Waldoboro will be presenting Yourville, an improv comedy show featuring this month's Creative Maine guests, Jeremy Brothers and Ryan Gall. For information and tickets, go to thewaldotheater.org. Finally, the Bangor Band will present its annual Harvest Concert on Sunday, November 3rd at 3 p.m. at Peaks Auditorium in Bangor, a musical treat for all ages. For more information, visit bangorband.org. For a more complete listing of events, visit our website, weru.org, and click the Community Calendar tab. If you would like to add an item to the community calendar, you may follow the prompts on the calendar page and submit your own event for the list. If you have an event that you feel is particularly pertinent to Creative Maine, send a note with the details to info@weru.org. and list Creative Maine in the subject line. You are listening to Creative Maine on WERU 89.9 FM and on WERU.org. Next up, Creative Maine discusses what improv comedy and horror films have in common. Welcome, Jeremy Brothers and Ryan Gall, to Creative Maine. I'm really looking forward to hearing about all your very interesting projects. I know that you, Ryan, are a native son who is back in Maine to do what you do best. And I hope we can hear a little bit about your journey to and from from and to Maine, and how you met Jeremy, and Jeremy, what you do. So we're talking about improvisational theater. And I don't know how many of us know what that really is. So can you describe improv theater? What is it? How does it work? And how do actors train for this type of theatrical genre?
You're asking a question that 25 years into studying the art of improvisation, I'm still figuring out every time I step on stage. But I and cut me off, Jeremy, anytime you want. But I would say for me, improvisational theater is the art of going on stage and acting and directing and writing your own scene in the moment in a joyful and sometimes scary and sometimes horrible and sometimes wonderful and sometimes as a failure and sometimes as a success, but jumping off that ledge every time you go on stage. And the first time I did it, I was addicted to it. And I've never looked back, but I will say, I don't know the answer to your question. I am still trying to figure it out.
A friend of mine who started doing improv before I did, and I asked her, I'm like, so what is it? And her definition was so confusing, I cut her off after a while and was like, I'll just go see it. So I would say that there's a lot of different forms improv can take. And some people are familiar with shows like Whose Line Is It Anyway, or some of the shows that have come out on Netflix that have like long form improv. But at its base, the actors are making something up, and I love the way that Ryan just phrased that in terms of acting, writing, and directing concurrently. But we take the stage not knowing what is going to happen, and whether or not we take a suggestion from the audience, or we play with a set of rules, or some sort of like game. It's all kind of under this larger umbrella of improv. And I think one of my favorite little adages is, improv is the art of being perfectly okay not knowing what the F is going on, right? And that is, it's scary, but it is also such an adrenaline rush to know that you're part of a group of people that we're all in this together, and we're all going to try to succeed or fail as a cohesive unit.
So tell me a bit about yourselves. So what were your creative journeys that brought you to improv and then eventually here to Maine?
Well,
Jeremy, I'm sorry, Ryan?
oh no, please. I was about to say, Jeremy, what do you think of that? No, I'm kidding. I was going to say, it's funny. I went to Lincoln Academy in Newcastle, Maine. I grew up in Damariscotta, Maine. And there was I remember seeing an audition. There was like a paper on the wall for the LA Players. And what we did is improvise scenes to teach schools about drug and alcohol awareness. And I was like, this is kind of cool. I was part of the DARE program, not to brag, but so I was like, oh, this is fun. I was always sort of a goof. I was the youngest of four children, so I was just desiring attention, as you can probably guess. And I'll try this. And it was basically improvisation around a pretty serious information. And even that started to get me like, I was like, I like this. I like being on stage when it's dangerous, when you don't know what's happening. So I went off to college. I went to Stonehill College outside of Boston, Massachusetts. And I did mostly dramatic theater, never thought anything about improv again. Graduated with a degree in English and psychology. And was like, all right, here I go. I'm off to, I guess, wait tables for
That and a
6 months.
dollar
And then,
fifty gets you on the subway, right?
exactly, I didn't know what I was going to do. And I went to a show and I saw I saw improv comedy in Boston, Massachusetts at Improv Asylum. And I remember, I can remember the seat I was sitting in and looking at that stage and being like, that's what I'm going to do. I know I'm going to do it. I don't know how I'm going to do it. I am going to do that. I would hang out at that theater every Friday and Saturday night, just waiting for them to invite me to do something. And eventually they invited me, not to be on the stage, but to take a class. And then I took a class and I was like, I'm gonna be the best person in my class. I'm gonna try to crush this. I have to. I know this is what I'm supposed to do. So that was the origin of where I started with improv comedy. And then eventually I went to Los Angeles, you know, joined the Groundlings, you know, taking classes at the Groundlings and joining their main stage eventually. And I've been doing that ever since. And that's, you know, I went to the Groundlings Theater. I took classes there starting probably around 2005, you know, around 2009, as if it was like med school, I was invited into the main company of the Groundlings and haven't looked back, you know. But to this day, the thing that brings me the most pleasure over acting in TV or over acting in film, over doing a play, is getting on stage in an improvised scene and wondering what is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy, how about you? I know you were part of Improv Asylum. Is that where you met Ryan?
That certainly is. I had a very kind of similar trajectory to Ryan. I did plays in high school, and I had kind of forgotten that I had a weird improv moment in a huge way in high school that kind of like gave me, I think, a little bit of a bug. But the theater club in my high school was really small, and everyone kind of knew what everyone else was auditioning for. So you wouldn't go up against your friend for the same role. So we would all kind of like decide like, okay, you audition for that, I'll audition for this. And there was this very bad show. I didn't really want any of the parts that my friends were going for. And I was like, I'm going to read for the role of the maid. If I read for it, maybe they'll just make it a butler. And I somehow like, he's like, no, the high school principal like was like, play it as a woman. And we did the entire rehearsal process where I just kept doing a bad falsetto. And eventually we had to realize like, well, this makes no sense. And we improvised an entirely new ending and probably broke the licensing for the play that we paid for. But we like created a whole new ending to this show, which, you know, was basically the reveal that this maid has been in a man the whole time. And it was real dumb. And as someone who's like written plays now, I think I'd be furious if anyone ever did that to my third act. But so I also, you know, went to college and was living in Western Mass and saw a show at Improv Asylum. And weirdly enough, I also remember exactly where I was sitting that first night and was like, uh-oh, nah, this is like what I want to do. Uh-oh, here I go. And I think I spent a lot more time in Boston, and I wrote a lot and directed a lot and eventually left the main stage of Improv Asylum and became the artistic director and did that for what seems like the majority of my adult life, working there at Improv Asylum between being in a cast and directing. So yeah, that's kind of where I've been.
So now the two of you have started to work together or have been working together for quite some time, and you've got a new show which you're bringing around. I guess you're on tour, is that fair to say? And you're going to be at the Waldo Theater. Tell us about that. What is Yourville all about?
You know, for a long time we discussed the idea of traveling and doing a show, whether it was regionally or nationwide or even globally. And we were like, well, let's start slow. And where would it be fun to start? And of course, we're both from the Northeast. And I had a connection to the Waldo Theater. And I was like, oh, this might be perfect. A smaller town that hasn't ever really been introduced to the idea of improv and to viscerally like feel it in the room. While we were working up there shooting a movie, we did a show at the Lincoln Theater in Damariscotta. We kind of felt that, where people almost were watching a magic show. And it was great, because we didn't expect that response. But most of these people had never seen improv before. And if you haven't seen improv before, in my eyes, I was like, oh, I'm giving them the opportunity to experience what I experienced the first time I sat in that very specific seat and looked at on these actors who were doing an improv scene, and watching them like they were David Copperfield doing a magic show, and just being like, how are they doing it? That's amazing. They're making this up. I can't believe they're making this up.
So tell us about the concept of Yorville.
Well, yeah. Yorville is going to be about your town, you know,
wherever
your
you are.
Community, wherever you are. So when we do this at the Waldo Theater, we're going to be using information, specific information from people of that community to build our show. We're looking at getting some special guests, so that I think we've talked about it, and like, oh, wouldn't it be fun to get like the local mailman or the local weatherman at a NBC affiliate, the mayor of Waldoboro, but regardless of where we go, we'll be able to get that from whatever quote unquote ville we visit.
What a great idea. What a great idea. What other vills are you visiting?
Well, Jeremy?
We are currently looking to do smaller communities right now because of exactly what Ryan was talking about. You know, you go to these towns and, you know, having spent time in New York and LA and Chicago, there are towns where you can't throw a stick and not hit a improv group. So trying to find these smaller towns in Western Mass or New Hampshire, and there are these great little theaters. So what we're doing is we're kind of like using the Waldoboro show to launch this. And then we've got, you know, some places that we're going to be announcing probably later this fall for the spring. But the concept is always going to be speaking to the audience, finding out what's going on with those individuals and their stories, and kind of building and weaving comedy out of the local community stories, and you know,
holding
what's...
it in. It'll be hilarious because everybody loves to hear about themselves and their own foibles. It's great.
And it's absolutely fun to have an outside lens look at this and go, oh, I'm sorry, you all bring in 30,000 people because you decorate your streets with pumpkins? What's going on, Damariscotta?
We met an older couple who was engaged in Lincoln County. I can't remember the town they were, but we interviewed them for probably 2 or 3 minutes and got this wonderful bucket of information from them, and then built this great, what I think was a very funny scene that lasted probably 5 or 6 minutes. And the look on their face, I can remember the look on their face, and they had never had something like that done in their lives. And this was probably a 80-year-old couple that we talked about their engagement. We talked about their honeymoon. We talked about where they first met, and we turned it into something that they could see on stage. And it was really special. And that, I think that was one of the things that we said, what if we could do that in a lot of different towns, in a lot of these towns where people have not experienced something like this?
What a gift. What a gift. Now, before, I heard you say something about shooting a movie. Talk about that.
Oh, boy. We are currently hitting the film festival circuit with our feature film, McCurdy Point, which is a found footage horror film that Ryan and I co-wrote. Ryan is exceptional as the one of the leads of the film. I co-directed, and we are going to be showing it around. It is about four guys who go to a cabin in Maine, and some terrible things happen.
Oh, my word. Well, that's not very funny, I don't think, is it?
Well, you need
it's
to
not
see
very
it
funny,
find out.
But you know...
Is it improvised?
There is definitely a lot of improvisation in the film. And what I always tell people, because people the question is always like, wait, you're in comedy, why would you make a horror movie? And I always say horror and comedy to me are very similar because it's about playing with the audience. It's about keep staying ahead of your audience and surprising your audience. And the only difference is you're either surprising them and making them laugh or surprising them and making them scared.
That's amazing. Well, how can our listeners either get tickets to your show, Yorville, or see the movie, or be one of those people that talks to you about their town? How do our audience members find you in one of those scenarios?
Well, first and foremost, the Waldo Theater website is the best way to check that out, which is going to be one night only right now. We've got, people couldn't go to the Waldo Theater website. We're going to be doing the show Yorville on November 23rd. It's a Saturday night, and we hope that people who are listening and who are curious about improvisation or think this might be fun, come out and check out the show because, like Ryan was saying about that older couple. What we do is we take the stage and we create something that is this shared communal experience that can never be replicated again.
How about McCurdy Point? I bet a lot of our listening audience can relate to a cabin in the woods in Maine and what might happen there.
If you would like to follow our journey through the festival circuit, please follow us on Instagram at McCurdy Point. At McCurdy Point, correct, Jeremy? Am I
Correct.
right? And we will certainly be doing some screenings in Maine. And the best way to know when and where those are going to happen will be through our Instagram page.
Excellent. And also, as ever, if listeners of Creative Maine would like more information, they can go to the website at weru.org and go to the Creative Maine page, and there will be more information on there. It has been delightful talking with you, Jeremy Brothers and Ryan Gall. Ryan, welcome back to Maine. And I very much look forward to seeing the product of all your labors. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much to my wonderfully engaging guests, Casey Ryder, Lisa Ladd and Nolan Welsh, and Jeremy Brothers and Ryan Gall. Our theme music is composed and performed by Arielle Chapman. If you have questions or comments for me or any of our guests, please send them to info@weru.org. Please write Creative Maine in the subject line. Please join Creative Maine at WERU 89.9 FM or on weru.org for another eclectic episode on November 21st at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, when we will learn about the beloved Maine institution, the Common Ground Fair, and the many wildly creative people exhibiting there. Thank you so much for listening. This is Adina Salmonson, wishing you a wonderful month of the arts and crafts that enrich your life and bring you joy.